and welcome to this month's Astropod. I'm Lauren Weiss.
And I'm Maciek Hermanowicz.
So Maciek, I heard that Rob Kennicott, the director of the Institute of Astronomy, won a prestigious award this month.
Yes, he was awarded a fellowship at the Royal Society, which is one of the highest distinctions you can get for scientific work in the UK. And big congrats to him.
Congratulations, well Rob.
And one more thing which makes me particularly happy about that is that Rob is my PhD supervisor.
Wow, well then you must be destined for great things too.
Right. Moving on, have you got any interesting stories you want to share?
Yes, actually. So it's not a story here on Earth, but on Saturn, there is an enormous storm kicking up. This storm is 3,000 miles across.
That sounds quite big.
Yeah, about the size of the US, actually. And it's a thunderstorm.
So how violent is that storm?
It's very violent, actually. This storm dredges up ammonia gas 30 miles or 50 kilometers into the atmosphere. So it's quite high. It's higher than planes fly.
So how did they find it? Was that discovered by Cassini?
This storm was actually discovered by amateur astronomers here on Earth using ground-based telescopes. But Cassini, which is an orbiter that's orbiting Saturn and taking pictures of it, is now following up this storm and gathering more and more data.
Is this the first time we've seen an event like that?
Actually not. Storms like this are very rare. The most recent large storm was in 1990, and there have been six storms since the 1870s, but this is the most violent one in remembered history.
Okay, that is quite impressive, and I'm sure it will produce quite interesting data.
Yeah, actually, they've just discovered that a cloud the storm has dredged up is composed of large ammonia crystals, so ammonia gas that has crystallized in the cold upper atmosphere of Saturn.
Which I guess is good, because it gives you a way of probing deeper into the layers of Saturn's atmosphere than you would normally be able to.
Absolutely.
Right, I think here's Laura with more of astronomy-related news for you.
Hi, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Endeavour's final mission. On the 16th of May, the space shuttle Endeavour launched from Cape Canaveral in Florida on its final mission. It embarked on a fortnight-long mission to deliver supplies to the International Space Station, including LEGO kits and the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. The AMS-02 is a science experiment that will hunt for undiscovered particles and cosmic rays. As for the LEGO, this is part of LEGO's Bricks in Space program. The astronauts will be using the sets to build models in the microgravity environment of the ISS. The crew will then link up with teachers and students to conduct experiments with the models. The final shuttle flight will be that of Space Shuttle Atlantis, scheduled to launch sometime in June. Superflare in the Crab Nebula. The Crab Nebula is a famous supernova remnant that was thought to be the steadiest bright source in the X-ray sky. However, on April 12th, NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope detected an outburst from the nebula that lasted 6 days. This superflare was also observed by other high-energy telescopes such as NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory and ESA's Gamma Ray Astrophysics Laboratory, Integral. The Crab is the remains of an exploded star, whose light reached Earth in the year 1054. It's 500 light-years away in the constellation of Taurus. There is a super-dense neutron star at the centre of an expanding cloud of gas. The neutron star is rotating very fast, swinging an intense beam of radiation towards Earth like a celestial lighthouse. The pulsed emission typical of spinning neutron stars is known as a pulsar. The Crab pulsar was thought to be very consistent in its emission until this unexpected brightening, which increased the nebula's normal gamma ray output by 30 times, around 5 times more than any previous flare. Alice Harding at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center said that, "We think these superflares are caused by sudden rearrangements of the magnetic field not far from the neutron star. To account for the observed emission, scientists say the electrons emitting the high-energy radiation must have energies 100 times greater than can be achieved in any particle accelerator on Earth." Free-floating planets could be more common than stars. Researchers in a joint Japan-New Zealand study have been studying surveys of microlensing events that took place near the centre of our galaxy during 2006 and 2007. They have identified up to 10 Jupiter-mass objects that do not appear to be associated with stars. These orphan planets are between 10 and 20,000 light years away, and based on the number of planets found in this dense region of the galaxy, they estimate that there could be up to twice as many of these free-floating planets as there are stars. Such objects have been seen before within young star-forming regions, and these are believed to have formed like stars through the collapse of a cloud of gas and dust. Such small dim objects don't have enough mass to burn hydrogen like stars do and are known as brown dwarfs. The smallest brown dwarfs are the same mass as some large planets, so the definitions can get a bit blurry. Planet formation is likely to be a turbulent process, and as solar systems settle down, we expect some planets to be ejected from their host systems due to gravitational interactions, either with other planets or nearby stars. If these free-floating planets form like stars, then the team would have expected to find only one or two in their survey, indicating that these planets might have been ejected from around their parent stars. That's all for this month's Astro News.
Thank you, Laura.
Right. Laura actually started talking about the last mission of Endeavour, and I have to say there's one quite interesting bit she didn't mention in the news section.
What's that, Maciek?
Spiders in space.
Spiders in space?
Yes, one of the experiments that got delivered to the ISS on board Endeavour is a small spider habitat containing, I believe, two fairly venomous spiders.
Wow. Is this the first time venomous spiders have been in space?
I know that there was a similar experiment done beforehand. I don't know how venomous that particular species was, but this one is supposedly fairly nasty.
So why would they bring this nasty venomous spider up into space?
Don't know, to keep the astronauts' life interesting. No, I'm just joking. The real reason is to see how spiders will weave their webs without the help of gravity. So the previous experiment that has been done with another species, which does your standard shaped concentric spider webs, actually produced some quite stunning images because the webs change dramatically. Now, this one, this particular species that got launched on Endeavour, is known for spinning asymmetric webs on Earth. So they want to see just how crazy it will look like when you launch them into space.
Right. Well, I remember seeing pictures from the last time they did this, and those webs were pretty crazy.
Yeah, I remember that. I also remember it looked quite similar to the experiments when they pumped some psychotropic drugs into the spiders' habitats on Earth and then observed how they weave their web while drugged. So I guess it just shows that lack of gravity can be quite a disorienting...
Experience,
yeah. Thank you. Right, I believe it's time for Alex with the history section.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this month's AstroPod history section. Our interviewee this month is Professor Martin Rees, who has held the post of Astronomer Royal to the Sovereign of the United Kingdom since 1995. In this month's edition, we'll take a look at the history of this rather grand title, and look at some of the famous names who have held the position down the years. The position was established with the foundation of the Royal Greenwich Observatory in 1675 by King Charles II atop the hill in Greenwich Park, London. A princely allowance of £100 a year was granted to the observatory's director, who would hold the title of Astronomer Royal and, I quote, apply himself with the most exact care and diligence to the rectifying of the tables of the motions of the heavens and the places of the fixed stars, so as to find out the so much desired longitude of places for the perfecting of the art of navigation. The Deacon John Flamsteed first held the post, and spent over 44 years making painstaking catalogues of the stars, greatly improving the quantity and quality of stellar positions. Flamsteed was succeeded in 1720 by the great astronomer Edmund Halley, amongst whose many achievements include the computation of the orbit of the comet now known as Halley's Comet, and detailed scientific studies of the Earth's atmosphere. Halley also famously turned his attention to a derivation of Kepler's laws of planetary motion. Upon travelling up to Cambridge in 1684 to discuss the problem with Newton, he was surprised to learn that Newton had already solved the problem with his inverse square law of gravitation, but had not published his proof. Halley encouraged Newton to go to print, and the resulting Principia Mathematica, perhaps the most important mathematical text of the millennium, was published in 1687 at Halley's expense. The post continued to produce important breakthroughs with Halley's successor, James Bradley, who discovered two astronomical effects of fundamental importance to the subsequent development of the subject. One was the aberration of light, an effect due to the finite speed of light and the motion of the observer transverse to the line of sight, giving rise to apparent motions of the stars distinct from the already known phenomenon of stellar parallax. Its other major discovery was the nutation or wobbling of the Earth's axis of rotation caused by tidal forces from the Sun and Moon, similar to the wobbling motion of a not quite perfectly spinning top. In 1792, the post of Royal Astronomer of Ireland was created by George III, its first incumbent being the Reverend John Brinkley. Between 1827 and 1865, the post was held by the great Irish mathematician and physicist William Rowan Hamilton, the creator of Hamiltonian mechanics and important contributions to geometry and calculus. In 1835, the title of Astronomer Royal for Scotland was created for the head of the Royal Observatory, Edinburgh, and its incumbents have included Charles Smythe, famous for his theories of the Great Pyramids of Giza, and more recently Malcolm Longair, former head of the Cavendish Laboratory here in Cambridge. The Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at Cambridge, Sir George Airy, was appointed Astronomer Royal in 1835, well known for his theories of the diffraction of light through circular apertures, for which he won the Royal Society's prestigious Copley Medal in 1831. Moving into the 20th century, Sir Martin Ryle held the post between 1972 and 1982, and won the Nobel Prize for Physics during this period for his development of novel techniques in radio astronomy, such as aperture synthesis. He holds a certain degree of infamy here at the Institute of Astronomy for his well-publicised arguments with the Institute's founder, Fred Hoyle, during the 1960s over Hoyle's steady-state theory of the universe, which somewhat restricted collaboration between the two groups during that decade. Ryle was succeeded as Astronomer Royal by Sir Francis Graham-Smith, and then Sir Arnold Wolfendale, with Martin taking over in 1995. While the post is no longer formally linked to the Royal Greenwich Observatory, it still holds considerable prestige in Great Britain, with the Astronomer Royal, at least in principle, always on hand to advise the Queen on any pressing astronomical matters which she may encounter in her day-to-day existence. However, I shall leave it to the listener to speculate as to which matters in particular Her Majesty desires to be advised upon.
This month's guest is one of the greatest figures in British astronomy. He's done seminal work on high-energy astrophysics, understanding quasars and cosmic microwave background. He served as the president of the Royal Society. He currently holds the posts of Astronomer Royal and Master of Trinity College. It's my great pleasure to welcome Professor Lord Martin Rees. Hello and welcome to the show.
Good to be on the show.
So before we move on to the next questions, why did you choose astronomy as your field of study in the first place?
It wasn't a very conscious choice. I studied mathematics and physics as a student and decided I would like to do a PhD. And I was taken on as a graduate student, and I was very lucky in two ways. First, I was allocated a very good supervisor, Dennis Sharma, who had several other students in astrophysics and cosmology. And also, this was back in the mid-1960s, and that was a good time to start a subject, because that was the time when the microwave background was being discovered, time when the first quasars were detected, first evidence for black holes, etc. And when a subject is new, it's good for young people because the simple things haven't yet been done by old people. And so we all start off together. And so it was a good time to be able to make an impact and do some original things, even when one was a beginner.
So have you got any favourite memory, any fondest memory back from the days when you started your research career?
Well, I think I was very fortunate to be in a group which included Stephen Hawking, who was 2 years ahead of me, and Brandon Carter, Michael Rowan Robinson, and a number of other people who have continued to be friends and colleagues ever since. So it was a good time to be in Cambridge, and I have very fond memories of Dennis Sharma, Fred Hoyle, and all the people who were the senior astronomers at that time.
Your most recent recognition was becoming the laureate of the Templeton Prize. What was your reaction to that award?
Well, it's a rather unusual prize that's given to a wide range of people, but it is given sometimes to scientists who have addressed big scientific problems. And someone who I have an affinity for, who won it a few years ago, was Freeman Dyson, who is a good friend. And when he heard I'd been awarded it, he sent me a note saying that it made him feel much better to learn I'd been awarded it, because I'd done as little to deserve it as he had. And I think what he meant is that we had just done our work and we didn't really expect to get this particular kind of recognition, which is not just given to scientists.
Do you think it's fair, though, that scientific research is viewed as stimulating the more philosophical questions about the nature of, not of life, the nature of humans?
Well, I think it's very important that any philosophical system takes account of what science tells us about the world and the universe and the immense stretches of space and time which are involved. And, of course, as we know from the wide public interest in our subject, there is a fascination with these big questions. And, of course, if we look at what's happened in the last few years, a wide public has been fascinated about the discovery of planets around other stars and the possibility of life there. And these are important questions, and I think it's a bonus that in our subject we can talk not just to fellow specialists about the technical details, but we can talk to a wider public about these big questions.
You've been very involved with public outreach. You've had plenty of experience in presenting science to the wider audience. So what is your personal reaction? What drives you to share those, share your discoveries with other people?
Well, I think in actual research, I've always enjoyed collaborating with other people, and I've worked with lots of collaborators. That's obviously cynically because they do a lot of the work, but it's more than that. It's that it is a pleasure to have people with whom you can discuss the details of your work. So I'm the kind of person who likes thinking things out in an interactive way with colleagues. But beyond that, I think I'd derive less satisfaction if I could only talk to a few colleagues about my work. I think it is good that what we do does interest a wide public, and I enjoy trying to meet that need. It is hard because we realize that they tend to ask the difficult questions which we haven't been able to solve. It's part of the methodology of science that you work on small parts of a big problem because you think you can only solve the problem one bit at a time. But of course, we tend to forget that the small part of the problem is only worthwhile insofar as it's part of enhancing our knowledge of the big picture. And so I think it's very good to be reminded of this. And often you're so focused on the details that you forget it. And to give one anecdote of this, Robert Wilson of Pengerson Wilson, who discovered the microwave background, he said in one of his reminiscences that he didn't realize how important his discovery was until he read an article about it in the New York Times, which talked about this as the afterglow of creation, because of course what he'd actually done was study his radio telescope and antenna and try to eliminate all the sources of background in technical details, and he was so focused, and rightly so, on the technical details that he was an expert in, that he hadn't realized at the time just how important it was. And I think it's only when we talk to a wide public that we do realize what the big issues are, and it's a satisfaction to realize that what we are doing will, in at least some condensed fashion, end up in the in history books as a contribution to understanding the world and what lies beyond.
Looking into the future then, what challenges do you see for science and for astronomy in the coming years? What scientific results do you look forward to seeing within the next few decades, let's say?
Well, I think it's important that if we look back over the last 30 or 40 years, or indeed over the last century, the advances in astronomy have stemmed from advances in instrumentation. It's certainly not the theorists are any cleverer, it's that they've had access to better computers and telescopes have improved immensely in power, and we have instruments in space spanning all wave bands, etc. So it's been the technical advances which have allowed us to make these discoveries, and also the advances in computer power which have allowed us to do realistic simulations of phenomena where we can't, of course, do direct experiments. And I think one encouraging aspect of the situation is that it is clear that technical advances will continue. Obviously in computer power, there's a new generation of telescopes on the ground now being planned. Also there are new space projects being planned, although I think the time horizon for them is getting depressingly long, but there'll certainly be a next generation of ground-based telescopes, and those allied with greater computer power for data analysis and for simulations offer great prospects. And I think if we look at topics I've been particularly interested in, one obviously is planets around stars, where Earth-like planets can't yet be directly detected. They can be inferred from the data in the Kepler satellite, but 20 years from now we'll be looking at planets like the Earth orbiting other stars, like the Sun, and that'll be fascinating. And also, we will fill in more details of how our universe evolved. We now can look back over 90% of cosmic history. We can look at galaxies which are newly formed, and one of the areas I've worked most on is actually trying to understand what you might call the end of a dark age, when the first stars formed lit up the universe for the first time, and how these stars, probably forming in systems smaller than galaxies, eventually developed into the galaxies that we now see. And I think by being able to study in more detail the very largest redshifts, the very earliest epochs, we will be able to understand how galaxies first came into being, when the first objects formed, how that happened, and of course fill in the details of how the universe evolved from its amorphous, dense beginnings to its present state. Because if we look at the advances in cosmology, they've come about from being able to look back further into the past directly. So I think understanding cosmic evolution from the early dense state to the present is going to be something which will be an ongoing quest with better and better instruments. And of course, there's another area which is not one where I'm an expert, but one which I follow, and that is the very early universe, more speculative cosmology. We now have a very detailed picture of the universe back to 1 second or even a millisecond. We know with a few percent precision what conditions were like then, but of course the key questions of what made the universe expand at the present rate with its present mix of atoms, dark matter and radiation, those questions can't be settled until we could understand the universe right back in the first tiny fraction of a second. And that takes us into a realm where the physics is too extreme to be simulated on Earth in a laboratory, which is therefore more speculative. So I think, as well as understanding more about our cosmic environment using telescopes, there'll also be advances in physics, which hopefully will enable us to firm up our understanding of the very, very early universe. And if I look back to when I started as a graduate student, at that stage, even the idea of a Big Bang was controversial. There was the so-called steady state theory being promoted by people like Fred Hoyle here in Cambridge. And if you told people then that we would now know the conditions in the universe when it was a second old, with the precision of a few percent, and have really, really good data, they'd be amazed. So that's been a huge advance. And likewise, in the next 40 years, we might change our present speculative ideas about 10 to the minus 36 seconds into a firm theory of what happened back then. And that'll settle fundamental questions like why the universe has the fluctuations in it, which are crucial to the formation of galaxies, why it contains dark matter, and also other questions which fascinate me, how much more is there to the universe than the volume that we can see with our telescopes? How much is there beyond the horizon? Are there other Big Bangs and not just the one that gave rise to us? Those are questions which are now speculative, but in the next 40 years, perhaps they'd be put on a firmer footing.
The future looks bright then.
I would think so. It's a good time to be a young astronomer, yes.
Excellent. Thank you very much. It's been a great honor to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Martin and Maciek.
Right. I've got another fairly interesting story for you.
What's that?
This one is about NEMO.
The fish? The clownfish?
No, NEMO actually stands for NASA Extreme Environment Mission Operations.
Ah, NEMO.
NEMO, yes. And and the 15th edition of that has been running throughout May. The aim of this mission was to prepare techniques for a human landing on a near-Earth asteroid.
Really? Have they picked out an asteroid?
No, basically what they're trying to do is prepare for the eventuality where we have the technique to send humans onto a close asteroid. The problem with that would be those objects are so small, they haven't got any gravity worth mentioning. So you would actually have to drill into the asteroid and anchor your equipment and yourself to it, just that so that you don't, just by pushing on it slightly, you don't get sent off into space.
Wow. Sounds as crazy and exciting and adventurous as a ship on the high seas.
Actually, under the high seas, because the experiment was taking place underwater, offshore from Florida, because that allows you to simulate very low gravity conditions using the extra buoyancy from water. So what they tried was using several different sets of model asteroid surfaces, because asteroids are quite varied bodies. They vary from solid metal to basically piles of rubble orbiting together. So you need different techniques to anchor into different sorts of surface. And they were practicing getting attached to an asteroid, moving along its surface over some longer distances between the different anchor points, and also collecting samples, because the aim of such a mission they were preparing for would be sample collection in return, and not sort of Bruce Willis style delivering a nuke to blow the thing up.
So I guess we're not going to be mining any unobtainium on these asteroids.
Most definitely not. Right, here's Alex with Sky at Night.
Up in the skies this month, it's eclipse season this month, with three eclipses all close to each other, known as a trifecta. As mentioned in detail last month, the first of these occurs on the 1st of June, with a partial solar eclipse that crosses over Siberia, northern Canada, and Greenland. The second is a total lunar eclipse, perfectly placed for any listeners in the Eastern Hemisphere. The best places to see the whole eclipse are Eastern Africa, the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent, where the moon will be covered for a huge 100 minutes, but with the eclipse starting around 8:30 at night and finishing around 10 p.m, the UK will get to the end of it as the sky starts to go dark. The final eclipse in this sequence of three is a far less impressive partial solar eclipse on July the 1st. Not only is the path of the eclipse through the Antarctic Sea south of South Africa, but also the indentation the moon will make on the sun's disk will be barely noticeable. As mentioned last month, Mercury, Jupiter, Mars, and Venus all continue their dance close together in the east in the pre-dawn sky. However, they are now starting to draw apart from each other, with Jupiter becoming the highest and brightest of the lot. It's still low in the sky and will look a bit fuzzy through a telescope, but this will improve as the month goes on, as it gets higher and higher. Not to be outdone, our solar system's second largest gas giant, Saturn, remains the planet to watch this month, high in the south during the night. Its rings are currently about 7 degrees from edge-on and will continue to be at least this visible for more than a decade, so there lie many years of good rings observing ahead. If the weather wasn't enough of a clue, it is definitely summer now, with the summer triangle dominating skies in the northern hemisphere. High in the eastern sky is the brightest of the three stars, Vega, and responsible for an ordering system of brightness still used by astronomers today. To its lower left, about 3 fists away at arm's length, is Deneb, and to the lower right, about 4 fists away, is Altair. Finally, Ursa Major, also known as the Big Dipper, dominates the sky when looking straight up. Under the curve of the handle are several Messier galaxies that you may be able to spot with binoculars. M51, also known as the Whirlpool Galaxy, is one of the more famous, and below the end of the handle, though it will be a challenge. And that's it for the sky at night this month. Now back to Lauren and Maciek.
Thank you, Alex. Speaking of the sky at night, there was a very nice conjunction last month of Venus, Mars, Mercury, and Jupiter.
Did you watch that?
No, I did not wake up in time for that. It was early in the morning.
Yes, not quite the PhD student's time in the day, is it? Actually, mentioning Jupiter made me think about a recent discovery about Io that has been made this month.
Oh, I really like Io. There's a good picture of it on Astronomy Picture of the Day. What's the story, Maciek?
Basically, a group of scientists reanalyzed all the data from Galileo probe flybys in 1999 and 2000, and they have discovered that Io actually shows signs of having a global magma ocean under its crust.
Really?
Yeah, so essentially they say that underneath about 30 to 50 kilometers under the surface of Io, there is a 50 kilometers thick layer of molten rock at temperature higher than 1200 degrees centigrade, which is essentially what's responsible for the outrageous amount of volcanic activity on this moon.
Right, yeah. I've heard that every 2,000 years or so, Io remakes its crust with volcanic lava.
Yeah, that is actually quite plausible. I mean, I've seen some statistics claiming that the total amount of gas produced by Io is 600 times bigger than the output of Earth. So given that it's a much smaller object, the volcanic activity there is really immense.
Yeah, well, I guess this large magma ocean explains it. But can you tell me, Maciek, what is different about Io's magma ocean under its crust? What about that is different from Earth's molten mantle?
Basically, the difference is the composition of the molten lava. It's classified as ultramafic rocks, which is
on
a technical
Io.
Term. Yeah, the magma on Io is ultramafic, which means its acidity properties are quite different from the standard lava on Earth. We have some rocks of this type. Some of them are found, for instance, on Swedish island of Svalbard. The samples of rock they have analyzed here on Earth, and lab analyses of those rocks allowed the scientists to state that when the rock is molten, it can conduct electric currents very efficiently, and which is quite different from your standard volcanic lava, which is an insulator. This one is actually quite a good conductor, which means that the whole planet behaves differently in Jupiter's very strong magnetic field, which is the signature that was seen and never really understood from the Galileo mission. And the reason why they made this discovery now is because of the very recent analyses of Earth rocks, because it is believed that both Earth and Mars and the other planets had oceans like that in their past, but they have solidified that they have formed the deep layers of Earth's crust. Whereas on Io, because of the interaction with Jupiter, the planet is heated up, so it still manages to support this molten magma ocean.
Wow, that's really cool, Maciek.
Right, and it's time for Michelle to brighten up the day with the astronomy joke.
Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Michelle.
Are you ready for my last ever astronomy joke of the month?
I'm ready for the joke, but not for it to be your last.
Oh, well, unfortunately it is. Okay, drum roll please. Why do astronauts like doing subtraction?
Why?
Because they're always ready to count down. Going out on a high.
Thank you very much, Michelle. And actually, for all of you dear listeners, it looks like it is a bit of an end of an era. We've made a full circle, and Michelle is the last person currently on the Astropod who was here with the original crew, and now she's graduating, so she won't be with us from the next episode onwards. We'll have to find you a new joke of the month.
Goodbye, Michelle. It's been a pleasure joking with you.
Oh, yes, it was. Thank you very much for all those jokes you've made on air and off air as well. Right, that's it for this month. And make sure you tune in next time. Take care. Goodbye.
Bye.